Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, different species of living fossil fish interbreed successfully despite 100 million years of evolutionary divergence, which is just weird.
That's like the equivalent of a primate successfully producing offspring with like an elephant or something. I mean, that's how deep the divergence is.
And rogue stars add chaos to the orbits of planets in our solar system.
The giant planets get kind of just jostled just a little bit. And as a result, for the next several million years, they exert a different gravitational influence on the Earth than they would have in the absence of that stellar passage.
Plus, modern technology helps maintain ice roads in the face of climate change, what animals did during COVID lockdowns, and the fate of fresh water. It'll drive you to drink. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. Scientists sometimes call it the anthropause. During the COVID lockdowns of 2019 and 2020, we humans changed our behavior massively. We didn't go to the office to work. We stopped traveling. And many people took refuge wherever they could find it. And for wildlife biologists, this was an extraordinary opportunity. It provided them with a huge natural experiment to see how wild animals would respond to this dramatic change in human behavior. Of course, they had to know just what the animals were doing, but fortunately, there was a new technology that had been quite widely deployed that made that possible. And Dr. Cole Burton and his colleagues took advantage of that by doing a massive study, looking at the response of more than 150 species of animal on multiple continents to the unprecedented change in the impact of humans on urban, rural, and wilderness landscapes. Dr. Burton is Canada Research Chair in Terrestrial Mammal Conservation at the University of British Columbia. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thanks, Bob. My pleasure to be here.
So what was the extensive technology that made this study possible?
Yeah, we used what we call a camera trap, sometimes called a remote camera or a trail cam. And it's actually a fairly simple device that just pairs a camera with an infrared sensor that detects when an animal walks past it and it takes a photo of that animal.
Where were these cameras positioned?
Well, we had them all over the place, actually. Many of us have been using this technique for some time now to try and learn more about wildlife populations and their behaviors. And so what we did in this study is we brought together over 100 different projects that were already using these cameras in different parts of the world to measure animal populations.
So where in the world were they?
Well, for my own research here, we tend to work a lot in Western Canada, in British Columbia and Alberta. We have colleagues working in Canada as well. We also teamed up with colleagues working all across the United States in a program called Snapshot USA, where they're bringing together their camera traps in almost all of the different states. And we teamed up with another group in Europe called Euromammals that had cameras deployed in France, Italy, Germany, Belgium, all kinds of different countries in Europe. And we further teamed up with researchers in South America, Southeast Asia, and Southern Africa.
Holy smokes. So how much video did you actually end up collecting from all these camera traps?
Oh, hundreds of thousands of images, probably millions and millions of images that we collected all together. And each team was responsible for going through all those images and classifying the different animals that they saw in the pictures, as well as people.
Boy, well, what was the range of animals that you saw?
Well, for our analysis, we looked at everything over 1 kilo. So we looked at animals as small as like a snowshoe hare or other rabbits, up to Asian and African elephants and everything in between.
Boy. Okay, so we're talking about the anthropause here, which was a change in human behavior. And since it was a lockdown, it might seem like human activity was reduced, but was that the case?
Actually, no, it wasn't. You know, this was our first surprise, is we had this assumption that, okay, we're experiencing these lockdowns, human activity is going to go down everywhere, and that'll give us a chance to see how animals responded. So we had a huge variation in how people were using these different landscapes where we were studying the animals. Where I was in Vancouver, many of us actually flocked to the outdoors where we could. So some provincial parks and other areas closed down. They did not have any people. Whereas some of the regional or city parks actually were open and people could get out of their houses. They could space themselves out and they could enjoy the fresh air and try and take some comfort in the outdoors. So some of these types of parks actually saw, you know, big increases in the number of people.
Wow. So what patterns then did you see in how the animals responded to these changes in human activity?
Well, you know, like with the people where we saw a lot of variation, we saw a similar thing with animals. So for some species, some populations, we saw them actually, you know, decrease when human activity was higher. In other populations, we actually saw them increase when human activity was higher.
Well, can you give me some examples of where animal activity either went up or down?
Yeah, one interesting example I think of, which is a study that we were doing near Vancouver, is we saw black-tailed deer in Golden Ears Provincial Park, which is not too far from Vancouver. We actually saw them decrease their activity during the lockdown and then increase their activity again when human activity increased when the park reopened. So that was kind of a surprise for us. But two interesting things about that got us thinking about what was really going on there. One thing is that when they increased their activity around people, they tended to be more active at night. So they were shifting to being more nocturnal when there were more people around. The other interesting thing is when we looked at their main predator in the system, cougars, the cougars were doing the opposite thing. So they actually increased their activity during the lockdown when nobody was in the park, but then they decreased their activity when people were around again. So this was kind of a neat example where we thought that the predator-prey interaction is changing and prey may actually feel safer in some cases around people, what we call the human shield, where humans are actually deterring predators because predators feel more risk around people.
What surprised you the most?
Well, I think after an initial surprise that we didn't see animals kind of responding in this way, that during lockdowns they increased, or conversely, when human activity increased, the animals decreased their activity. We saw this real variation. One of the other surprises for us was that how animals responded depended on the type of area they were living in, the type of landscape. And more specifically, it depended on how much that landscape had been modified by people. So when we looked in more remote areas, like more wildland areas with very little development of the landscape, animals in those landscapes were actually more sensitive to people when human activity was higher. They tended to be more wary of people and reduce their activity when human activity got higher. Whereas when we looked in more developed landscapes, like closer to cities or towns, or, you know, lots of farm fields, other types of changes to the landscape, those animals tended to actually increase their activity on average when human activity increased again. So we saw that it depended not only on the types of species, but also on where the species were living as to what kind of response they had to human activity.
So what did you learn from this COVID experiment that might be relevant for animal conservation?
Yeah, great question. And I think a couple things stood out to us. One is that in these more remote landscapes, these more wildland parks where there's less development of the landscape, managers might need to be thinking about how much overall activity they're going to allow. Because when we saw animals in these landscapes tend to reduce their own activity when there were more people, that suggests to us that these important landscapes could be subject to disturbance if they get too crowded. So that's one thing to keep in mind for managers. But when we think about the context of the more developed landscapes closer to where we live, We know that animals, if they're still persisting there, they have to share those landscapes with people. But what we might want to think about is protecting the nighttime for them. Since they did seem to shift to being more active at night in these landscapes, we may want to limit our nighttime disturbances, you know, keep people out of parks or not using lights in, at night in parks, or provide safe passage over roadways that are busy at night for these animals so they can continue to use these landscapes that do have lots of people in them.
Dr. Burton, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. It's nice talking with you.
Dr. Cole Burton is Canada Research Chair in Terrestrial Mammal Conservation at the University of British Columbia. Delaunay in the Northwest Territories, 544 kilometers north of Yellowknife, is the only community on the shores of Great Bear Lake. It's so far north that conventional road systems don't even reach there. But during the winter, the community builds ice roads across the lake. This enables hundreds of transport trucks to bring in the food, supplies, and fuel that the community needs to survive. But, much like everywhere else in the Arctic, as the climate warms, the ice is becoming less stable and less predictable, which makes these ice roads even more difficult to build and maintain. Despite an abundance of traditional indigenous knowledge behind their construction. But recently, the community has had some technological help to overcome these uncertainties.
There you go. Leave it alone.
Sweet.
A team from Wilfrid Laurier University has been using advanced technology, like drones and remote sensing, to not only help determine the best path for the ice roads across the lake, but also to understand the changes happening in the ice as the season stretches on. Dr. Homa Kairola-Poor is an assistant professor, a Canada Research Chair in Remote Sensing of Environmental Change, and the director of the Cold Regions Research Center at Wilfrid Laurier University. Hello and welcome to our program.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I understand you just got back from Delaunay a few days ago. What's it like up there right now?
It was cold and it was awesome. It was beautiful.
Well, tell me about the ice roads that service that town.
The ice road is about 6 to 7 kilometers, and it's connected to the winter road that comes all the way from Yellowknife and goes all the way up to Northern Wells and so on.
How have ice roads traditionally been built?
Traditionally, they start to monitor the ice, drilling the ice 2 meter, 3 meter distance through the road, the six kilometers, in order to map the thickness of ice on the lake. But because the ice is not constant in terms of thickness along the lake, so they have to make sure that every piece and every corner of the ice is safe enough for the ice road to be built. So that took for them probably weeks of monitoring and making sure that they can map it by drilling. But that changed totally with the new technology nowadays.
Well, tell me about your research. What type of technology are you using to help build these roads?
We are trying to combine multi-approach methods in order to help communities and science. While we are still heavily used or based on satellite observations and modeling, we are also using ground-based monitoring techniques such as smart sensors and drones. Drones are flying drones or underwater drones. And we use it to watch the cracks and pressure ridges from under the ice bottom. And we also attach some different water quality sensors on it so that we can drive it and swim and map basically temperature, chlorophyll concentration, oxygen, pH, and so on.
Wow. Okay, so you've got drones under the ice, you've got drones flying above the ice. What other technology are you using?
Yes, we are flying drones to monitor cracks from above and to measure basically the snow depths. We use a snow and ice mass balance sensors, we know as SIMBA for short, These sensors are measuring ice thickness and snow depths at 15-minute intervals. They are basically a chain of digital temperature chips. We plant them in the ice through the snow and ice through the water. So it gives us the thickness of ice, give us the depths of snow and the temperature for water and atmosphere.
So what are you learning about how the ice has been changing over time?
Basically, the effect of climate change on ice is super simple. This warming is impacting the formation of ice and growth of ice significantly, and these changes are happening much more faster up north. Because of that, ice forms later and melt earlier in the season. So the ice season is getting shorter and shorter and less safe. But this is based on the climate impact that we have in the long term. So the weather impact is also very important and happening very quickly, actually. By that, I mean the variability in weather, where sometimes the temperature is changing from minus 40 degrees Celsius to minus 5 degrees Celsius overnight. So which is creating lots of stress on ice, and it creates pressure ridges and cracks. And this is something that is really, really impacting the health and like well-being and safety for the community that they are driving overnight. And they don't know that the cracks happens or pressure ridges are happening somewhere that is over two meter that they cannot even pass it by skidoo anymore.
Wow. So the fluctuating temperatures can degrade the quality of the ice? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, because as the ice warms or cools, so changing like 20 degrees overnight or 30 degrees sometimes, it expands and shrinks the ice. So this will cause a lot of tension and compression in the ice sheet. So it definitely makes the ice weaker and resolve a lot of cracks and or pressure ridges in some area.
So what does this mean for the future of ice roads?
Community has a long history of building the ice road traditionally, so they do have the knowledge. But the changes that we are facing today are happening fast and is complex. So we are basically helping to include these new smart technologies in addition to the traditional knowledge to keep up with this complex ecosystem change. And also it builds capacity in the community. And the part that I'm very excited about is we can use the excitement of community youth for technology to be more out on the land more often, because now they out there, they can use also the technology that they are excited about. It makes the process of building the ice road much faster as well. They can own the technology and they can actually use their own capacity to use this technology and to apply it for better decision-making.
Dr. Khairul Lapoor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. And it was definitely a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Homa Khairul Lapoor is an assistant professor, a Canada research chair in remote sensing of environmental change, and the director of the Cold Regions Research Center at Wilfrid Laurier University. Science is usually about finding evidence that helps clarify the way things work and improve our understanding of the past or the future. But sometimes it works the other way. A case in point is a new study about stellar flybys. As our solar system circulates through the Milky Way galaxy, it encounters other stars, and these stars can influence the orbits of the Earth and other planets around the Sun. And this new study is showing that these stellar encounters can make it much harder, maybe even impossible, to understand past changes to our planet's orbits. This has huge implications for understanding the history and the future of the planets, including the Earth. Dr. Nathan Cabe is a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and lead author on the new paper. Hello, Dr. Cabe. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Before your latest study, what was our understanding of how the orbit of the Earth and the other planets can change over time?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, there's been a lot of work done in the last, I would say, 30 years
We take basically a snapshot of our solar system as it is today. And instead of taking a computer simulation and running it forward in time, what we do is we take that snapshot and using what we know about gravity, which we understand that pretty well, we run everything backwards. When you do this type of simulation, you find that the orbits of the planets are very chaotic. Just a slight uncertainty in, say, the position of Earth. And why I say slight, I mean like a meter or something like that, something much smaller than we actually know the position to. Once you get back to about 60 or 70 million years, information about what the planets are doing is dominated by that initial uncertainty. And so that basically prevents us from knowing the positions and velocities of the planets infinitely far back in time or infinitely forward in time.
Oh, I see. So 60 million years is sort of your cutoff point there. You don't really know what happened before that.
Yes.
Now, what effects do these perturbations in the orbits have on the Earth?
So they basically cause its orbit to become more elliptical. And what that means is that rather than maintaining a constant distance from the sun, over the course of a year, we would get a little bit closer and a little bit further. And that affects the total amount of sunlight hitting the Earth. And the cool thing is, when you look at the time period of these fluctuations in Earth's ellipticity of the orbit, you can go and you can look at the time period of fluctuations in the sedimentation of ocean cores extracted from the floor of the ocean, and you see the same periodicity. And what people have concluded is that these perturbations actually have some effect on the global climate. And it makes sense because it affects the total amount of sunlight that the Earth receives. Mm-hmm. And so understanding those orbital fluctuations is key to try to understand why there have been changes in, say, the global climate in the deep past, like 56 million years ago, that there's a big warming event, to understand why we would hope to know exactly what the Earth's orbit looked like at that point.
Okay. So what did you think was not being taken into account in these models of the Earth's orbit over the past 60 million years or so?
It's been known that, say, for instance, even the gravitational pulls of the largest asteroids can have important effects on our predictions of what the Earth's orbit's doing over 50, 60 million years ago. So that kind of got us thinking, if things as insignificant as asteroids matter, maybe things outside of our solar system matter, and in particular, maybe the gravity from passing stars matter.
Now, I understand that you looked at one particular stellar encounter in your study. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's a really cool star. It's HD 7977, and it's kind of like the sun, and the sun is a pretty normal star. But the cool thing is that over the last few years, there's this European Space Agency mission called Gaia, which has measured the velocities of stars to incredible precision. And with that data, people have been able to backtrack what stars have done. And this particular star is thought to have come very close to our solar system about 3 million years ago, 2.8 million years ago.
How close did it come?
It could have come as close as about 4,000 AU, which is 4,000 times the distance between the Earth and the sun. That's extremely close. That would have been maybe one of the 10 closest encounters in the history of the solar system. Or it could have come within about 30,000 AU. So there's about a factor of 10 uncertainty.
Well, let's take the closer value.
Sure.
If it did come as close as you think, how long would it take, like, to pass by?
It would only be there for a few centuries, which is, you know, the blink of an eye in terms of the history of the Earth.
Would we see that from the ground?
I haven't worked out the math, but I'm confident it would be the brightest thing in the night sky besides maybe the full moon for those few centuries that it was nearby.
Boy, maybe the Australopithecines saw it 2.8 yeah, million years ago.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what kind of changes to our orbit did you observe when you simulated this passing of a star close to our solar system?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. When you do that, the Earth is almost totally unaffected directly by the star. But the giant planets of our solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, they're a little bit further away from the sun and a little bit less tightly held by the sun's gravity. And they get modest perturbations. So their orbits, things like their eccentricity and how inclined they are relative to the Earth's orbital plane, those things change by not a huge amount, but by like one part in a million. And that's still a relatively small amount, but it's huge compared to those like 1 meter uncertainties that I told you about earlier that our outcomes are dependent on. And so the giant planets get kind of just jostled just a little bit. And as a result, for the next several million years, they exert a different gravitational influence on the Earth than they would have in the absence of that stellar passage. And so this perturbation kind of bleeds throughout the rest of the solar system. And so it affects ultimately the trajectories of the Earth and the other planets as well, Mercury, Venus, and Mars. And the difference in outcomes between one version of the universe where there was that stellar passage and another version where there wasn't that stellar passage, the difference between those two parallel universes grow over time quickly. And after about 50 million years, the Earth's orbit looks totally different, whether you account for that stellar passage or not.
Okay. So then what does this tell you about how well we can predict what happened to the Earth's orbit over time? You said the cutoff period there was 60 million years. We can't go back. But if you include stellar passages, how does that model change?
Our best guess is that rather than being able to predict 60 million years in the past, it comes down to 50 or 55 million years, which is interesting because I mentioned before that there is this really strong warming event at 56 million years. And so it'd be really nice to know what the orbit of the Earth looked like during that warming event. But it's just a lot harder than we thought.
Oh, so you can't make the correlation yet between the warming period and the passing star.
Correct. Yeah. Wow. And so basically, your possibilities in the 50 to 60 million year time range become much larger than you would have thought because there's a lot of uncertainty, which means that there's a lot of different possibilities for what Earth's orbit could have been doing.
Based on the positions of stars that are around us now, is there any prediction of when the next one might pass close?
Yeah, there's a star called Gliese 710, and that is going to come within about 16,000 AU of the sun in about 1.5 million years. Oh. And that's another significant encounter, like a once in every 10, 20 million year event. And so we're kind of living in an interesting time in terms of stellar encounters. So we've had a pretty rare stellar encounter just happen in the last few million years, and we'll have another fairly rare one happen in the next couple million years.
Interesting times indeed. Dr. Cabe, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nathan Cabe is a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute. I'm Bob.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, host of The Big Story. For 6 years now, we've been telling one story a day, every one of them about something that matters to Canadians. This spring, though, we're going deeper. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt, the inside story of Ontario's Greenbelt scandal. From political games to stag and doe parties, endangered species, RCMP investigations, and Las Vegas massages, you will hear the full story. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt. New episodes every Monday, and you can get them all by following The Big Story wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, Wither Water. Fresh water is a precious resource. We're not treating it that way.
We're reducing both water quantity and water quality. But that double whammy is going to really affect water availability to us moving into the future.
Look at them all in here, Pete. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. 6.
What an awesome-looking, weird-looking, crazy-looking fish.
That weird-looking fish caught by the hosts of the Fishin' Canada show in the Ottawa River is a long-nosed gar. And if you've ever seen them, you know they look kind of prehistoric. They can grow more than a meter long, with armored scales and long, slender snouts filled with razor-sharp teeth. Charles Darwin famously called the gar living fossils because of the striking similarities between the gar he knew and their fossilized ancestors from millions of years ago. Now, in a new study, scientists found the reason they look so much like their prehistoric ancestors is because, genetically speaking, they're practically still the same fish. Chase Brownstein from Yale University led the study. He's a PhD student in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Hello, Mr. Brownstein. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell me about the different gar species alive today. How similar are they?
Gars are a group of 7 living species. They're found throughout North America, and we divide species into sort of bigger groups we call genera. There are 2 living genera of gars. So the long-nosed gar that you mentioned earlier is in one of those genera. the alligator gar, which is an even bigger fish found in the southern United States, and then through into the Gulf of Mexico, because it can actually go into the marine realm occasionally, is part of that other lineage. So we have two lineages, seven species, and they don't appear to have changed really that much at all from fossil relatives 50 million years ago.
It's interesting you call them alligator gars because they kind of look like alligators with the long snout and long body, but they have fins instead of legs.
That's true.
How did you go about studying the evolution of these so-called living fossils?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing that we had noticed was that in at least aquariums, and actually when we were kind of going through the study, it became more apparent to us that this was happening in the wild as well, that gars, the long-nosed gar lineage and the alligator gar lineage, those two lineages could produce hybrids in an area in the southern United States where they overlap. Now, this might not be too crazy to someone, because if you look at an alligator gar and a long-nosed gar, sure, they're different, but they're not as different as, say, you and I and a wombat, for example, or a kangaroo, right, or a whale. But the thing of it is, these lineages goes back to about 105 million years ago. That's when they last share an ancestor. Now, what's incredible about that is about 30 million years before Tyrannosaurus rex appeared on the scene. So they're still hybridizing, even though they've diverged from one another. And that's like the equivalent of a primate, for example, like a chimpanzee, successfully producing offspring with like an elephant or something. I mean, that's how deep the divergence is. It's almost comical. This is actually the oldest hybrid cross. In other words, it's the two lineages across all organisms. There isn't anything with an older divergence that can hybridize.
So how are they able to produce hybrids?
What we did is we said, well, okay, let's look at their rate of change across their genomes. And we found that gars and then another group of, you know, quote unquote, living fossil fishes, sturgeons and paddlefishes, which are also found in North America, we found that these two groups have the lowest average rates of change to their DNA, right? At least among the thousand or more sequences we sampled, right? Of all jawed vertebrates by several orders of magnitude.
So what's behind that? What's causing that slow change in their DNA?
Yeah, so that's the search now. That's what we're working on. And we have several hunches, but I think the strongest one that I would stake my bet on it would be some sort of DNA repair process. In other words, they're stopping the substitutions to their, you know, DNA sequences before the substitutions get locked in there.
Oh, I see. So if some kind of mutation comes along and tries to alter their DNA, they can repair that and not let it take over and change them.
Bingo. Yeah.
Well, is there something that we can learn from this, a practical application to understanding how the gar has been unchanged for so long?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, first of all, if they are possessing really strong DNA repair genes, I mean, that has a lot of, you know, implications for human health, I think. I mean, we're constantly learning, you know, how DNA repair works. It's sort of a, you know, a hot field right now. And if we can sort of extract some interesting and important information on how this works in these living fossil lineages, assuming that this is important there, I think that could have a big impact. And also, I think on the other hand, though, I think, you know, it's important to highlight this, you know, conservation aspect. So gars, sometimes they're kind of treated as sort of quote unquote trash fish. They aren't really considered the best meat and things like that. But I just want to highlight that like North America is this kind of refugium for like these exceptionally old fishes that did live during the time of the dinosaurs. And it's the only place we can find them on Earth. That's true for gars. It's true for paddlefishes because the Chinese paddlefish was just declared extinct. So the paddlefish in North America is the only one surviving today. It's true for these things called moon eyes, which are from a really weird group of fishes. There are these things called trout perches and cave fishes that are, you know, really old. So North America has this like kind of really cool cast of ancient fish and vertebrate species. And we need to pay attention to that, because I think often we think of like the coolest animals, you know, maybe they're not necessarily right next to where we live or where many of us live in North America, but they are. And it's important to highlight that.
Mr. Brownstein, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Chase Brownstein is a PhD student in ecology and evolutionary biology at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Water is one of the major components of what makes our planet special. Without it, we wouldn't have life. We'd just be another rock orbiting a star in the cold deadness of space. But of our water, 97% is salty, found in the oceans. Less than 3% is freshwater. That's the water we have in glaciers, rivers, lakes, wetlands, and in the ground. Freshwater is vital for both people and wildlife. It's how we grow our crops, nourish our ecosystems, and stay hydrated. So you'd think that we would treat it as essential and valuable. But unfortunately, we have been careless with this precious resource. We're using too much of it. We're contaminating it with our pollution. And through climate change, we're even disturbing the systems that nature uses to supply us with water. And researchers around the world are ringing the alarm that we need to stop taking our fresh water for granted before it's too late. This week marks the United Nations World Water Day, an annual event to highlight the importance of this precious resource. So Quirks and Quarks producer Amanda Buckowitz has been digging into the state of the world's fresh water. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, Bob.
So why did you want to start looking into what's going on with our planet's fresh water?
Well, let me ask you, Bob, how's the weather where you are in Victoria?
Well, it's warm and weird. We're supposed to be in the middle of our wet season, but aside from a few heavy rainfalls last month, we really haven't had much precipitation, and we don't have much snow in the mountains either. I think the official count was British Columbia's at 66% of our normal snowpack. How is it for you in Toronto?
It's also been warm and weird. We barely had any snow this winter. And whenever we got any, we were hit by a super warm spell immediately afterwards, and it just melted away.
Sounds like it's been warm and weird everywhere.
Yeah, it does seem to be a universal complaint. But I'm not here to make small talk about the weather. I'm here to talk about water. But this weird and wacky weather is a reflection of one of the problems we've created for our freshwater resources. Those resources are now under pressure like never before, and human activity is making the problem worse, not better. Because essentially, we are changing the way that nature distributes water around the planet. And thanks in part to global warming, that's now having noticeable and disruptive effects on water resources.
We really should start to see the global water cycle for what it is. It's a global crucial aspect of the Earth system that we all depend on, all life on Earth depends on that. And so it is our shared responsibility.
So that's Dr. Mina Porkka at the University of Eastern Finland, whose research looks at the impacts of human actions on the global water cycle. Does that sound familiar? Do you remember learning about that in grade school?
Oh, yeah. That's the whole cycle where you start out with moisture in the clouds. It condenses, falls as rain or snow, and then that fills the lakes and the rivers. All rivers flow to the ocean, and then water evaporates back into the clouds, and you start all over again.
A-plus work. And the amount of water and timing of its circulation in this system has always been pretty predictable throughout history, with some natural variations year to year. So Dr. Porkka's team really wanted to understand more about those variations.
Yeah, so we wanted to understand, first of all, what is the sort of less disturbed global water cycle? What does it look like when we look at stream flow, which is a key component of the water cycle for aquatic ecosystems, for instance? And then we also looked at soil moisture, which is very important for terrestrial ecosystems, for instance.
So they wanted to understand under normal conditions where the water is and where it goes?
Exactly. So looking at watersheds around the world, they calculated monthly stream flow and soil moisture going back to the pre-industrial period in the year 1661. And then they compared everything all the way up to the current time frame and combined the effects of all the ways that humans are interfering with this global water cycle. So things like constructing dams, irrigation for agriculture, deforestation, and global warming. And they found that for the past 100 years or so, humans have been pushing the Earth's freshwater system far beyond the stable conditions that they require to function normally.
So what does that actually look like?
Well, one of the places that they studied was in Africa, in the region just south of the Sahara Desert. Now, they used to get a pretty reliable rainy season, which allowed them to time their planting and harvesting. But now they get hit with these extreme dry periods and then extreme wet periods because of climate change. And that's just devastating for their agriculture. Another spot they looked at was in India.
We could see a big increase in dry stream flow deviation. So drier stream flow conditions combined with increased frequency of wet soil moisture deviations. So less stream flow, more soil moisture. And we think that this is because of the large scale agriculture or irrigated agriculture that is very prominent in that region.
So the streams are drier than before, but the soils are wetter than before because of irrigation systems moving water around for agriculture.
And in my personal opinion, that is probably bad news. We know that ecosystems have adapted to a specific variability. And so our hypothesis is that once you start deviating from that normal variability, you may start having serious ecological impacts, serious impacts on the cycling of water itself. And that could then turn into ecological impacts elsewhere, not just in that current region.
So it's a major change to the landscape with implications that we don't entirely understand yet. But there are more obvious changes that the variability in the water cycle is having that we can see here in North America too. Like earlier, we were talking about the snowpack in British Columbia.
Yeah, it's really down considerably this year.
Yeah, exactly. It's an example of this variability. So some fluctuations year to year are to be expected, but we are fluctuating between record highs and record lows far more than ever before.
So these past several years, or especially this winter, is a great example of this boom and bust cycle of extremes when it comes to when and where we have snow and rain.
That's Christina Aragon. She's a PhD student at Oregon State University, and she studies the relationship between water, snow, and climate.
And so essentially, our snowpacks function like natural reservoirs. They snow water throughout the winter and then gradually release that water throughout the spring and early summer. And then it becomes available for our human needs and for ecological needs. And this is really important because over 1/6 of the Earth's population depends on snowmelt for water resources.
1/6 of the Earth's population? That's a lot of people. So we're talking about things like the snowmelt water feeding the Fraser River in BC or the Saskatchewan River on the prairies?
Yes, that's right. And because the snowpack feeds these vital rivers, it's really important for understanding things like flood risk or how much water is going to be available downstream for drinking or agriculture or industry. So there are people whose job it is to manage water, and they need to know how much water to expect to come from the snowpack. But the old way of calculating that amount of water is no longer accurate. So Christina and her team recently came out with a completely new metric to calculate it.
What do you mean by that, no longer accurate?
Well, the old way of calculating how much water was in a snowpack was just based on a single point of time. Like looking at the length of the snow season and saying, well, this is how much water is in this amount of snow. But with the up and down temperatures we've been having and the periods of rain instead of snow, even way up in the mountains, there was a lot more melt happening, which means you don't actually know how much water is stored at the end of the season just by looking at time. So they had to invent a new way that actually takes into account these day-to-day fluctuations when calculating how much water is actually stored for the upcoming year.
The traditional snow metrics can't capture that high variability that you see throughout the year. So this metric can still give you an estimate of snow water storage, even if your snowpack is coming and going. You still get an idea of how much snow was stored on the landscape for a given amount of time, whatever period you're interested in looking at.
Oh, I see. So the old way was kind of like looking at how much you drive in one day, which some days might be 10 kilometers and others you have an epic road trip and go 400 kilometers. And the new way is looking at the whole year with all the highs and lows in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. But what do these changes mean for the amount of water these so-called reservoirs are holding?
Well, when applying this new metric to the snow falling in mountains of the western United States over the last 40 years, they found some pretty drastic declines.
So mountainous regions contribute an average of 72% of the annual snow water storage, despite covering only 16% of U.S. land area. And the annual mountain snow water storage across the U.S. has declined by 22% over the last four decades. So that is quite substantial.
Declined by 22%. Wow. But you mentioned that there are fluctuations, so some spots must be getting more water.
Absolutely. And that's happening right here in Canada. We're a big country, so it should come as no surprise that freshwater issues are different as you go from province to province.
As we move out west, drought is more of a factor, and so that's going to cause lake levels to decrease and salinity to go up. We're not going to see that likely in Ontario, where we have a lot more precipitation occurring.
This is Dr. Katrina Moser. She's an associate professor and the chair of geography and environment at the University of Western Ontario. She's also a paleolimnologist, which means that she uses lake sediments to look back hundreds and thousands of years to understand the history of water quality changes.
Now, she mentioned Ontario's expecting more precipitation. So how does that affect the water supply?
Well, for one, it can increase flood risks. So like, if you're thirsty, chugging back 10 liters of water in one go isn't exactly helpful. It'll overload your system. So our infrastructure and our natural ecological processes are designed for a predictable rate of water. And further, more precipitation can also lead to increased erosion and change nutrient availability to aquatic ecosystems. And that can lead to algae blooms, for example. And it's not just the amount of water that's changing.
Water resources in Canada are really being affected in two ways. We're reducing both water quantity and water quality. And that's not even across Canada. Some places are, you know, we're having a bigger impact on quality. Some places we're having a bigger impact on quantity. But that double whammy is going to really affect water availability to us moving into the future.
What's changing the quality of the water?
Much of that is happening because of direct human activity. Irrigation, pollution, agricultural runoff, algae blooms, like I mentioned. And much of that is happening because of the chemistry of a warming planet.
This winter, right, ice cover was down by a lot. And the Great Lakes, for example, end of February, they were about one-tenth of what the average ice cover is. And that's just completely unusual, right? The other thing when we remove ice cover is that we give more time for water to evaporate. So that means we can see lake levels decrease and salinity increase. And again, if you change salinity even a tiny bit, that can have profound impacts on the organisms that are living in those lakes.
Okay, Bob, so now we're getting to the kind of water that most of us don't really think about. It's a really important resource, but it's largely invisible. It's the water that's stored under our feet, groundwater.
And what's happening with the world supply of groundwater?
Well, first of all, you need to know that it's an awful lot of water. The ground actually stores 30% of the world's freshwater, which is more than all the lakes on the planet combined.
Wow.
I know, right?
Groundwater is everywhere under your feet on the landscape. At some depth, if you started digging, you would reach groundwater everywhere on Earth.
That's Dr. Scott Giuseppe. He's an associate professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara's Bren School of Environmental Science and Management. And he studies the quality and quantity of groundwater resources in the world.
Groundwater is very important. It's important for drinking water supply. Several billions of people on planet Earth rely on groundwater for drinking water supplies. About 10 million Canadians rely on groundwater for drinking water. It's also very important for food production. It supplies nearly half of the water that we use for irrigation projects globally, which is critical for keeping foods on plates in Canada and abroad.
What has he found about the state of the world's groundwater?
Well, Dr. Giuseppe and his colleagues recently completed a massive groundwater study looking at 1,600 aquifers with 300 million measurements of 1.5 million wells in more than 40 countries. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but they found some significant decreases.
These data tell us that groundwater levels are declining. And they tell us that groundwater levels are declining, particularly in dry places and dry places where we grow food. What's even worse is that we're finding that the rate that groundwater levels are declining has, if anything, accelerated in the last 20 years. So groundwater depletion is a bad problem, and it's getting worse faster. Some of the fastest declines that we see in our analysis of global aquifers can be up to 3 meters per year, which is very rapid. These are often places that are underlying cultivated lands in arid landscapes. We found particularly rapid rates of decline in parts of the Western United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Chile, India, and China.
Well, what's happened to the world's groundwater?
Well, we've been drawing it out faster than nature can put it back in. And that goes back to the water cycle that we talked about earlier. It deposits water onto the land, and some portion of that soaks deep into underground aquifers. And that's what we tap when we dig a well.
It's kind of like a bank account, but we're withdrawing faster than nature can deposit.
That's right. So here's Dr. Giuseppe again.
Groundwater is our best rainy day fund, but really it's a dry day fund. We use it during times of drought.
So groundwater is the world's most extracted raw material. 70% of the groundwater that we take up is used for agriculture. So for growing food, industrial crops, raising livestock. And of course, we have to feed the people of the planet. But we really do need to be smarter about the demands we're placing in this global water system.
Boy, Amanda, do you have any good news for us?
As a matter of fact, yes, because Dr. Giuseppe and his team also found some bright lights among the aquifers that they were looking at. So these are parts of the world where the water supplies are actually recovering.
The final major finding of our study is a ray of hope. We did find some rare cases where groundwater levels were declining in the 1980s and 90s and have recovered in the 21st century. These cases are rare, but I think they provide illustrative examples of how we can make things better.
How did these areas recover their groundwater?
Some of it was policy-based, so like in Bangkok, Thailand, where the government stepped in and substantially increased fees for pumping groundwater and set limits so that people couldn't just take what they wanted when they wanted. Some of it was about finding alternative sources of water and redirecting them. One method was something called leaky lakes, which is what it sounds like, large man-made lakes that redirect water underground to replenish aquifers.
The big lesson that we can take away from this is that groundwater depletion is not an inevitability. Humans have agency, and there are interventions we can put in place to turn things around and fix this problem.
So the solutions are there. We just have to put them in place.
The typical Canadian and American has their greatest indirect impact on groundwater when they open their fridge, or better yet, when they go to the supermarket. The foods that we purchase require water, and sometimes that water comes from groundwater in places where groundwater levels are declining. So individuals can make decisions about the food they buy, and those decisions will have indirect impacts on groundwater.
Do the people you spoke with actually believe we can turn things around with our water?
Yes, absolutely. Because of all this work looking at understanding the problem, we have a clearer picture than ever before of what needs to be done to turn everything around. Water's been here for billions of years. It can absolutely recover if we let it.
Since we found out that adding human pressures has a really fast effect on the water cycle, then naturally, you know, decreasing that pressure could also have a very fast impact on the water cycle.
I mean, climate change touches every aspect of our lives. So our water resources are just a piece of that puzzle. And that's ultimately what motivates me, is that there are solutions. It's just a matter of actually taking action as opposed to being apathetic in order to drive change.
How fortunate we are in Canada to have so much fresh water. And I think we often take that for granted. Just the Great Lakes are, you know, about 20% of the world's surface fresh water. And so with that incredible fortune, privilege, also comes a responsibility to protect that water.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks, Bob.
Amanda Buckowitz is a producer here at Quirks and Quarks. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks was produced by Amanda Buckowitz and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.